From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Trust me, there's a reason we're opening this hour of Education Friday with a little earth, wind, and fire. After all, the Finger Lakes grape-growing region deals with rain, snow, hail, earth, wind, and fire. And specifically, the region is celebrating because of September. Yeah, there really never was a cloudy day in September in the Finger Lakes wine region, and that's only mild hyperbole. The Finger Lakes wine industry was dreading the 2014 vintage until September. Then everything changed. If you drive through the region now, you will find harvest finally cranking away. And one man who has toured the region more than perhaps any other is Hans-Walter Peterson of Cornell Cooperative Extension's Finger Lakes Grape Program. Hans, welcome to the program. How good, we've been hearing that September was the best ever, and it's always easy to say that in the moment, but just how good was September for the Finger Lakes grape growing region?
It was exactly what we needed when we needed it, I would say. It's probably people know that the year has been kind of a wet one up until now and kind of cool, and September just all of a sudden turned on the sun and dried things out and was exactly what we needed. The grapes were kind of behind a little bit in their development as we were getting into the ripening period, and all that sunshine and dry weather really helped them to move along really nicely. So now we're pretty much where we would normally expect to be in a quote-unquote average year.
Not that there is any average year anymore in the Finger Lakes, Hans, but
right, exactly.
but this is, I think, an important time to back up, because one of the things we like to do on programs like this, it's Education Friday on Connections, is learn a little bit about what it takes to get here, because we're in the midst of harvest now in the Finger Lakes, but a lot of what's happening now has been built by the previous months. And if we go back to the winter, remind us, as good as September just was, just how bad was the winter?
Yeah, and it's actually, looking back, it makes September feel even better to everybody, I think. This past winter we thought was going to be really devastating to a lot of vineyards, given how cold it got. And our early indications when we were looking at survival of buds and vines throughout the Finger Lakes was giving us some concern. We were seeing pretty high numbers of buds that appeared to be dead in the samples that we were collecting throughout the vineyards. And we and a lot of growers were pleasantly surprised that a lot of those numbers didn't actually come to fruition for whatever reason. There are certainly spots that had a lot of their crop reduced and had some vines not survive very well, but things looked a lot better than we thought they were going to. So between that and, like we said, kind of a wet spring and early summer, things were not looking that great for the year. It was looking like one of the tougher years around. But like I said, September really just pretty much saved our bacon. It's one of those months that, we had the same experience last year where basically things were not looking that great going into the ripening period, and September just all of a sudden became warm and sunny. In this case, lightning did strike twice.
And you don't want to get into the habit of that, because typically September brings almost 4 inches of rain on average in the Finger Lakes, which would have been really, really rough this year. What was the actual rainfall instead this year?
We had in Geneva, which is kind of where we have our official weather records based from, Geneva had less than an inch of rain in September. And other places were certainly less than an inch and a half or under 2 inches. So, I mean, we have half or less of the normal rainfall that we get in September. And that's really important, not just for being able to be outside and be harvesting, but that's really important for disease development. We have a couple of different kinds of rots that can set into the grapes as they ripen. And those rots are promoted by the fruit and the canopy being wet. And so when we don't have that rainfall happen, the disease pressure goes down a lot. It makes life a lot easier on everybody, and it ends up with better fruit coming into the wineries.
As I am wont to do this time of year, I've been peppering some of the winemakers and growers around the region with questions on how things are going, because they love hearing from me when they're busy with harvest. They love taking the time to have to email back. But in hearing from nearly 20 different winemakers and growers in the last week or so, a common theme came up, which is that August, as great as September was, August was a bit of a curveball in that when we see veraison, and I'm going to ask you to explain that term in just a minute, when we see veraison in vineyards, that is typically around the time when summer heat is still cranking, and so the acidity, which starts out really high in grapes, starts to drop off as sugars rise in August. And this year, it was such a cold August relative to normal that acidity has still been very preserved, and that even with the great September we just had, we're still seeing high acidity, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just sort of where things are. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. Like I said, veraison is just a term that we use for when the grapes go from being hardened green, they're starting to soften, and there's sugar starting to accumulate in the berries. And that's kind of what we call the beginning of the ripening period, this last part of the growing season. So from veraison to harvest is that time when the sugars are loading up, or the berries are loading up with sugar, and the red grapes are starting to turn color and all that kind of stuff. And generally what happens at that point in the season, we start to see, as you were saying, the acidity in the grapes start to drop. And we like to have some acidity in the grapes because that helps with flavors and everything, but you don't want to have too much because then that's all you taste. And when we have cool conditions, especially cooler nights, which we did have in August, then the acidity doesn't drop out as fast. The plant uses the acidity, the acids in there, as kind of a energy source for part of their physiological processes. And so when things are cool at night, they don't do that process as much, and so we retain a lot of the acidity. In the Finger Lakes, we like that to some extent. Varieties like our Rieslings and even Chardonnay and some of the reds even, in our style of winemaking, tend to be a little bit more acidic. It makes them a little more fresh and lively. And so, as you were saying, we at this point in the season, we still have a little bit more acidity than we're used to because we've still had relatively cool nights, even though we've had some nice sunny conditions. It hasn't been a terribly warm September, kind of close to average overall, I think, but we haven't had a lot of warm nights to kind of burn some of that acidity off. So it's still something that I think a lot of winemakers are trying to hang on to the fruit a little bit longer, let it hang out there a little bit longer to maybe hope that acidity drops a little bit more, but probably not too much.
And the interesting thing, having talked to Dave Breeden, winemaker over at Sheldrake Point, he said exactly the point that you're making, which is that September was maybe a little warmer than average, but it wasn't a hot September. It was just dry with a lot of sunshine. So Dave tells me there is such little disease pressure that he feels no pressure at all on himself as a winemaker to get the grapes in, and that if he's trying to get more of a season out, if he's trying to extend the ripening window, that there isn't a risk that you're pushing it because of possible disease. And what's more typical around this time of year, Hans?
In a lot of years, a lot of growers and wineries are picking based on trying to prevent the fruit from rotting. Like you're saying, we get almost 4 inches of rain on average in September, and so that can really cause some problems if we get close to that number. And so a lot of times, for certain varieties that are especially those that are more prone to rotting, you're going to go out and pick before that fruit really starts to fall apart and develop those rots. And sometimes that's not quite when you would prefer to pick it. You know, you'd like to let it hang out there a little bit longer, develop a little bit more flavor, a little bit more sugar in there, let the acidity come down a little bit more. But if you can't do that because of disease pressure, you just have to bring it in and deal with some of those issues in the winery if you need to. In years like this, and last year was kind of to an extent, and some of the really great years that we've had in the past, 2007, 2010, growers and wineries could let the fruit hang out there and pick it when they want to and not when they have to. And that's one of the big differences that we kind of look at around harvest time is were we able to pick grapes when we wanted to or when we had to.
When it comes to disease pressure, one of the lessons I've learned over the years in the Finger Lakes is obviously rain can help cause that, but rain followed by almost tropically warm weather is another aggravating factor when it comes to disease pressure. And I see that here on the forecast could hit 80 degrees on Tuesday, could get rain, and I would probably be too much of a pessimist if I asked you if you're worried about that, because the warmth is great, but is there any concern that if we see rain Sunday, Monday into Tuesday, and then you get 80 degrees, then all of a sudden disease pressure is back?
If there are conditions in a vineyard where they're kind of right on the edge of having an outbreak, then I would probably be concerned about that. I'm probably more concerned just about the fact that there's going to be rain for a couple of days, and the warm temperatures probably aren't quite as troubling at this point in the year. The rots and the diseases we worry about between, you know, at this time of year are effective whether it's hot or cool. They can reproduce and multiply and spread over a pretty wide range of temperatures. So whether it's hot or cool is about a little bit less of a factor than just the fact that it's wet on the canopy. And so the thing about it being warm after just a rainfall is that then the humidity stays high which prevents the canopy and the fruit from drying off as fast. So that's probably as much of a concern about temperature as actual kind of the heat driving the organisms forward. So that would probably be a little bit more of a concern, is just that the humidity would be up, which would not let water evaporate off the fruit in the canopy as fast, which can drive some disease development.
All right, and when it comes to water in the canopy, this is, you know, rainfall is not something you want excessive amounts of in a vineyard. But, you know, I remember the first few times I was out working in a harvest, and some of the basic questions that our listeners may have, which is, it's one thing if you've got grape juice and pour water into it, you can see that it gets diluted. But grapes are sort of, for lack of a better word, sealed, Hans. So explain why when it rains, it causes a concern about either ripening, dilution, other issues.
When it rains right before grapes get picked, we can sometimes see a little bit of a dilution effect actually in the fruit. The fruit isn't totally sealed off from the plant. It is still importing what we call photosynthates, all those things, primarily sugars, that the leaves are producing. There's not a lot of it going on at this point, but there's still some. Some water still can come into the fruit, and so we'll occasionally see a little bit of water dilute the sugar and the acidity and everything in the berry. And so a lot of times what growers and wineries will do is if they have a rain before they pick, they'll actually even maybe wait a day or two, and hopefully some of that water kind of comes back out. It moves back and forth through the plant a lot. And so some of that water will kind of push back out and kind of get the sugar and everything back to the concentration that it was before that rainfall.
We're talking to Hans Walter Peterson with the Cornell Cooperative Extension's Finger Lakes Grape Program. And Hans is busy, as all Finger Lakes winemakers and growers are. We've got a few more minutes with Hans, and let me just ask Hans, it's certainly interesting to a lot of people that grapes don't all ripen at the same time. We have a category that we kind of refer to loosely as early ripening, and then there's categories like Riesling and Cabernet Franc that can go late. On the early ripening side, you have Pinot Noir. Most of our listeners are going to be familiar with that, and the Finger Lakes has seen a surge in prioritization of this variety among many growers. And I'm wondering now, as great as September just was Pinot the biggest beneficiary?
It was probably one of them. Again, mostly, well, we go back to disease. Pinot Noir is a very hard grape to grow in an area like the Finger Lakes.
It's dainty. It's dainty.
It has two problems, or too many things that make it difficult. I shouldn't say problems. One is that the skins are fairly thin, and the other is that the clusters are usually pretty tight. And so it's hard for them to any kind of chemical controls if you use those, or just, again, for water to dry out from that cluster. And then the skins are thin, and so they can either burst very easily or they're very easy for diseases to penetrate. And so a dry September and dry conditions help to keep disease from developing on that fruit. And so because Pinot Noir is so susceptible to some of these rots that we worry about during the harvest season, you're probably right. It probably was one of the biggest beneficiaries of those conditions.
Did most growers have Pinot fruit that at least survived into September to benefit from that, or was the prior disease pressure costly?
It wasn't too bad. There were some places a lot of places that were struggling with disease on all varieties earlier on this year, Pinot among them. Pinot seemed to actually survive the winter pretty well, which kind of surprised a lot of us. We kind of thought Pinot would be hit a little bit more because of the cold conditions from this past winter. So there's Pinot Noir out there, there has been, and it's probably just about wrapped up. Most of it's probably in by now. We had some early stuff come in for sparkling wines several weeks ago, and I know a lot of it was coming in the past couple of weeks for red wine, for still wine production. So most of it's probably in now, and we'll get a sense as we talk to people after harvest is done about kind of what yields were like and things like that. But there's definitely Pinot out there, and it seemed to come through pretty well.
And Hans, I know you worked with Senator Schumer, and you've worked with lawmakers who want information when things are rough in a region. They were there earlier this year following that damaging winter, and there was a conversation about sort of opening up allowance to either assist the region in some way or even allow the region to bring in juice from outside the region to kind of boost production if production was going to be low this year. Do you know where
right.
that stands, and have you been able to communicate with winery owners down there about where those developments stand?
A little bit. I think the programs that Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand were promoting from Washington for the growers and through the Department of Ag and Markets with New York State, I don't think many growers took advantage of those, just because just kind of the way those programs are structured. And again, I mentioned before, the way the damage actually worked out, growers didn't have as much damage as we thought they were going to. So that was a good thing. The other piece that we worked on with the Department of Ag and Markets was, like you were saying, assessing the amount of crop loss to see if there's a provision in the farm winery law that would allow farm wineries to go outside of the state to buy some fruit if there's a certain amount of yield loss across the state. And there are several varieties around New York that did suffer that much loss. I think it's 40%, based on a bunch of surveying that we did with our colleagues across New York, and also some surveying that we did. And so farm wineries are able to go outside of the state this year to supplement the grapes that they get from New York growers if they need to. But I think in my experience and talking to some of the wineries and growers that I have this year, I don't know how many people are actually going to take advantage of that. I know some are, but the industry here has put so much effort into promoting the Finger Lakes name and the Finger Lakes region that I think they would rather have some less product on the shelves than put out something that doesn't have Finger Lakes, especially Riesling.
Yeah.
Certainly that's not the case across the board. There are a few places that are doing that this year. You have to keep your market once you've got it, and so you can't blame them at all for that. But I think there's not going to be quite as many as some people may have thought would take advantage of that because of that investment they've made in the Finger Lakes name.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I'm hearing as well. It's great to catch up with you, Hans, and you know, no one writes the story before it's done on a vintage. We've learned that lesson over the years here.
That's
but,
right.
But I suspect now, when you are visiting growers and winemakers right now, the mood has... Look, everybody would love to be 2012 and you're mostly done with harvest by now as opposed to really just getting going, but my guess is the mood has really changed.
It has. People's attitude about this year has really shifted a lot in a very good way. So a lot of people are feeling very good about this year now.
Well, keep up the great work, and we'll check in with you once vintage is over, but thanks for educating us on the process out there, and have fun with it. This is a fun time of year.
Absolutely, it is. It's the best time of the year if you're in this business.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, a remarkable new way to construct a hand. 3D printing turns its attention to serious medical needs. Then we'll go back in time to the days when going to the movies meant hearing live musicians offering the soundtrack in person, right there in the theater. We preview the upcoming Organ and Film Festival. That's Monday on Connections.
The singer Ásgeir is huge back home in Iceland.
So few people speak this language, so Iceland always has this mystique about it.
The Sound of Iceland, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on your NPR News station.
Welcome back to Connections. Chances are someone you know suffers from sleep apnea. On this Education Friday, we're looking at how the medical community is trying to educate patients about their options. And yes, there are more options, some new options you might not be familiar with regarding sleep apnea. The medical community is touting Sleep Apnea Awareness Month. We're talking to Dr. Jake Lyons, a doctor of pulmonary critical care and sleep at Rochester Regional Health System, about sleep apnea. And you know, Dr. Lyons, that when it comes to awareness weeks or awareness months, it seems like there's an awareness week or an awareness month for just about anything, but I always look at other recent news pegs to talk about. And sleep apnea, there are some new ideas or treatments. We're going to get to those in a second. Let me back up, though, and just start in more general terms. How often are we seeing sleep apnea in the general population?
Sleep apnea is a very common condition. If you were to look at what we call prevalence data, meaning how frequent is this seen in the community, it is extremely common. Some estimates, depending on how you determine the severity of sleep apnea, can be as much as 20 to 30% in men, which is a huge number. 1 in 5 or 1 in 3 of men in North America is estimated to have sleep apnea. Women, not as much, 15%. If you were to be a little more stringent in terms of people who have sleep apnea and have daytime symptoms, which is one of the most common symptoms, daytime sleepiness, then the numbers go down a little bit, but still quite a bit. You're talking 15 to 20% in men and slightly less in women.
Has to be related to obesity.
Does not have to be related to obesity, but obesity is the biggest risk factor.
Okay. Okay. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, as we've seen America get a little bit more progressively heavy as a collective population, have we seen sleep apnea numbers, or at least
definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
Over the last 5 to 10 years, the frequency of sleep apnea has risen, and that is directly attributed to the increasing prevalence of obesity in America.
Now, if the numbers are, again, 20 to 30% men, that's what the number you gave us, right?
That can be, yeah. That's
that doesn't
number.
Mean diagnosed, though, right?
That's right. That would be what we describe as prevalence. You just take a population and who has it. Now, undiagnosed sleep apnea is also a big issue.
A big and potentially life-threatening.
Yes. So sleep apnea, if I see patients in my office and I tell them about sleep apnea, sleep apnea, if severe enough and untreated, can increase your risk of a variety of other comorbidities. And we're talking high blood pressure, strokes, heart attacks, and even death if severe enough and untreated.
When you try to educate your patients about this, do most come in thinking they have sleep apnea, or do most come in because they have general problems and you have to educate them about sleep apnea?
So most people come in because their wives or spouses tell them to come in.
See, this is another example of when people say married men live longer, because there's always a spouse who's pushing them.
And I think that is absolutely true. There's a lot of people who come into my office and they're not kicking and screaming, but you can see it in their eyes that they are kicking and screaming as their wife or spouse is sitting right next to them, describing what they do at night. They're saying that they don't have a problem at all, and yet at the end of the day, they would end up having some form of sleep apnea.
So they think they don't have a problem, but their spouse can't sleep.
That's right.
Because of them.
And they're the ones who bring them in.
But to be clear, more severe cases of sleep apnea, I've heard cases of people sort of starting and stopping breathing, and that can probably wake you up, or at least very much disrupt the quality of your sleep.
Yeah, so that is one of the most common reasons people come in on their own. So they are waking up because they're not breathing, and they don't come in and say, "Doc, I stopped breathing during my sleep." They wake up saying, "I woke up suddenly and I couldn't breathe. I felt like I was choking. I was gasping for breath." They're not coming in saying that I stopped breathing, but they're coming in with the recognition that when they woke up, they had a sensation that was not pleasant.
And what do you do about that?
So, well, that's, if they come in and say, I'm waking up gasping, or I'm waking up feeling short of breath, that's a pretty good indicator that they have obstructive sleep apnea, meaning that the back of the throat is closing off. They're not getting air into their lungs. And it would be like if I were to come in and just choke them in the middle of the night, they would certainly say, hey, I don't like that sensation. Wake up and start breathing again. And so what do? Well, we bring them into our sleep lab, or we do have home sleep studies for certain populations, and we try to evaluate whether they have a problem or not. Some of the problem is that the patients, because they are brought in by somebody else or kind of forced to come in to see me, they don't want to undergo testing. And I can't say that I don't blame them, but the testing is not as bad as some people describe.
I'm reading in the New York Times about this notion of the home test. And Donald McNeil writes about his own experience 10 years ago with the hospital test versus the home test. And in his reporting, he talked to a past president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, who said that the home test costs about, well, insurers prefer it because it costs about $300, as opposed to almost 10 times that on average for a hospital test. And a company called Novasom, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is offering these home tests. And you're not downplaying it. You're saying it not for everybody, but an option.
Oh, it's definitely an option. There are certain patients out there who come into my office, and it's not a question of whether they have sleep apnea or not. It's really how severe is it, and what other physiologic parameters are associated with that sleep apnea? How bad does their, or how low does their oxygen saturation go? And those home studies are typically good enough to figure that out, meaning that if someone comes in with classic symptoms, they're falling asleep during the day, their spouse comes in, they say, he stops breathing at night. Well, if they don't have any other comorbidities such as heart failure or lung disease or other sleep disorders that are raised, such as seizure disorders or parasomnias, then a home study is perfectly adequate. And what they do is they go home, and there's a bunch of different home study setups out there. The one that we have at our center is essentially a belt on the chest, a belt on the belly. You wear something on your finger to look at your oxygen saturation, and you wear something that looks like what we call a nasal cannula, which is something that sits in your nose. People would kind of recognize it as if you ever see someone who's on oxygen out and they have something on their nose. It looks exactly like that. And
that's for the home test.
That's for the home test.
Is it easy to do it correctly, or is there a concern that it wouldn't be worn correctly?
Well, if these are pretty easy to put together.
Okay.
You know, you kind of just put a couple wires in here, and it's really, you know, we try to make it as dummy-proof as possible. But some people, you know, that's not for them, and then we bring them into the lab. But for the most part, you know, if you're young and at least have some kind of technological savvy, it's a slam dunk.
And this may not be your expertise, but insurance seems to cover it from what I've seen.
Yes. Insurance is, they're still trying to figure out kind of where the home study fits into the what they're going to pay for. Some insurance companies actually require prior authorization for any form of testing, which doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. But for the most part, it's covered. You got to go through some paperwork, some hoops. It's a little bit of a pain, but it's not that big of a deal.
So how often, regarding the breakdown of patients who come in with potential sleep apnea, are you going with home test versus hospital test?
You know, I don't know the exact percentages, but I still think that the in-lab study is probably more often ordered. But my population is a little bit different since I'm a pulmonologist as well. I see folks who probably have more likely to have other comorbidities like heart failure or lung disease. But if you were to take the general population, it might be 50-50. Around.
Might be 50-50.
And that's a rough estimate.
Yeah, but that's certainly more than I think a lot of people would know about. A lot of people still don't know about the home test. We're talking to Dr. Jake Lyons, a doctor of pulmonary critical care and sleep at Rochester Regional Health System, talking about sleep apnea, new developments and approaches, and what we all ought to know about sleep apnea, which before we even started the conversation, it occurred to me that I was asking, I said, you don't work in pediatric care, but at the same time, children can have sleep apnea.
Children can definitely have sleep apnea. The vast majority of the time, although I will make a disclaimer that I'm not a pediatric sleep specialist, but the vast majority of the time, pediatric patients who have sleep apnea, it's typically associated with large tonsils. And the treatment, the first round of treatment, if it's appropriate for that child, is to undergo a tonsillectomy. And if that corrects the sleep apnea, then all over. But because of the obesity epidemic, it's not only occurring in adults, it's also occurring in children as well. And that is becoming an increasing risk factor for the development of sleep apnea in children, let alone the enlarged tonsils.
Now, when you talk to parents about the possibility of their children having sleep apnea, is that a shock to them?
I don't think it's a shock for a lot of parents who see their children do it on a nightly basis.
You mean struggle to breathe,
right.
Struggle to sleep.
Right. I mean, and just like adults, children who come into a sleep center, they're already pre-selected for likely having some form of problem. So a lot of, again, I'm not a pediatric sleep specialist, but I don't think it's a shock to hear that sleep apnea is a possibility in their child.
I also have to think that for a child with sleep apnea that either goes undiagnosed or certainly untreated, the long-term implications are very concerning.
I don't know the answer to that question. That would probably be best left to a pediatric sleep
specialist. We can probably surmise, though, that
it wouldn't be a long shot.
Yeah. Now, I can think of my own father's case when my dad was turning around 60, he was hitting afternoons where he would tell me after lunch, he would hit a wall of fatigue like he has never experienced before. And it was directly related to sleep apnea. They sent him home with a CPAP or BiPAP machine. Is there a difference?
So there is a difference. Both can be used to treat sleep apnea. CPAP is the standard of care, means CPAP stands for continuous positive airway pressure. That means that you get one set pressure throughout the night. There's some modifications to that. It makes it a little more comfortable on those CPAP machines. They've gotten a lot more sophisticated over the years. Whereas BiPAP is a bi-level positive airway pressure, meaning that when you breathe in, you get a little bit of more pressure, and then when you breathe out, you get a little bit of a lesser pressure.
And most of the time, patients who need breathing assistance get CPAP, not BiPAP?
CPAP. CPAP is the standard of care. BiPAP can be used for a variety of patients. Some people who don't tolerate CPAP, they find BiPAP more comfortable. Hmm. And then people who have lung disorders where they have elevated carbon dioxide levels, frequently BiPAP is used to help them. But CPAP, by and far, is the treatment, the first line step.
And he's in another state. And so, Dad, if you're listening online, you can correct me on this. But my recollection is he did not take to the CPAP machine and was told that 5 to 10% of patients really just can't sort of get acclimated to it. And then I think he moved to BiPAP and he's been doing fine.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people who say, I can't wear CPAP. But if they have buy-in and you have a doctor who has buy-in, I think that you can get most people treated effectively with CPAP. There's acclimation. There's a variety of steps that you can go through to have someone who's on CPAP try to get used to it and fix their problem. And when you correct obstructive sleep apnea, and it doesn't matter how severe it is, if you can correct sleep apnea, a lot of people will feel a lot better. I have patients who I think they would kill me if I tried to take their CPAP away. That's how good it feels to wake up in the morning having their sleep disordered breathing corrected.
We're talking to Dr. Jake Lyons. I almost changed your last name, doctor. It's Dr. Jake Lyons, doctor of pulmonary critical care and sleep at Rochester Regional Health System. And they're trying to educate people this month about sleep apnea and options out there. Another New York Times story that caught my eye was regarding these masks. And the mask is attached to the machine, the breathing mask, right?
That's right.
Okay, so the New York Times reported in January about a possible alternative to masks. Tell us a little bit about what you know about this option.
So there's actually a couple. The article that you're referring to is, I'm pretty sure it's called a hypoglossal nerve stimulator, mm-hmm. which is an implanted device which stimulates the hypoglossal nerve when you inhale to move the tongue forward. And if you think about how sleep apnea occurs is that it's actually the back of your throat which closes off. So a lot of people have the tongue fall to the back of the throat, and that blocks the airflow getting into your lungs. And that's what sleep apnea is. Now, frequently, a lot of people don't have what we call obstructive events, meaning that there's actually no air getting in. But sleep apnea it's a constellation of obstructive events and also a reduction in the airflow, so that affects your sleep. And so even if you have a narrowing of the back of your throat, it affects your sleep to the point where you actually have arousals throughout the night. And so if you can just move that tongue forward and limit it from blocking off the back of the throat, if that's your problem, other people have obstructions elsewhere. But the tongue is kind of the major player. If you can move that forward and with one of these devices stimulate the tongue to move forward when you breathe in, then you could potentially correct the problem. I think it's still in its early stages, but there was a good study out there showing a reduction in the what we call the apnea hypopnea index, which means how many times per hour do you stop breathing or slow your breathing down. And this study showed that there was a good reduction in that AHI, that apnea hypopnea index. And if that makes people feel better, then that could be a good, a reasonable alternative. I think that larger studies need to be done. We'll kind of figure out where this, you know, fits in terms of the treatment of sleep apnea. And just completion is that there are other devices. There are what we call mandibular advancement devices, or something that your dentist would make, which actually kind of just brings your jaw forward. Those have shown to be helpful. There's some surgeries that have shown to be helpful, and then there's a new device where you put it into your mouth, and it's actually kind of a little bit of a vacuum. It's called the Winx system, W-I-N-X, and that actually kind of sucks your tongue forward. In my experience, I've never had anyone undergo the hypoglossal nerve stimulator placement. That's a surgically implanted device. We've used these other devices, and thus far, and I'm hoping that things do get better, because there are people out there who hate CPAP. But thus far, those other ways of treating sleep apnea just don't seem to be as effective in terms of getting you down to a number or a frequency of your stoppages or slowing down of your breathing into the normal range.
But we could, as you say, it's early on. There's a lot
Definitely.
To monitor.
We could certainly get there. People are working on it. And, you know, it's a great business opportunity. People hate CPAP. Some people love it.
Well, like you said, some people swear by it and
some
would kill you if you tried to take it from
will,
them.
You know, you couldn't rip it from their, you know, from their dead hands. But there are people out there who are just like looking for something else.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting stuff. By the way, I haven't seen a commercial for Breathe Right in years. Is that sort of considered bunk, or is there anything to it?
No. It's not bunk. It's certainly not something that you would use to treat sleep apnea. You would use it to improve nasal airflow. We use a lot of nasal steroids because a lot of people in this region, the allergy season is hot, and you use a lot, and you try to improve the nasal airflow as much as possible. That's how we're supposed to breathe.
But not related to sleep apnea.
Well, you know, can it be? It can. If you think about how you breathe, if you breathe in through your nose, then your tongue is actually up at the roof of your mouth, and it doesn't fall back. If your nose is clogged and you start opening up your mouth, then the tongue is more likely to fall back. But it's certainly not the treatment of choice for sleep apnea.
How often do you see fit people who come in with sleep apnea symptoms?
So great question.
Compared to overweight.
Yeah. You take some of my worst sleep apneics are thin guys. They run, they're as fit as they can be, but just anatomically, their facial structure predisposes them to having severe sleep apnea. And that's where you kind of run into the family history, meaning that, you know, if you ask them, their father had sleep apnea and he was a thin guy. And
but that's got to be infuriating for someone who thinks of themselves as fit and doing all the right things, and then they have sleep apnea.
Yeah, it can be infuriating. It's shocking to them. But the fact remains is that they're just predisposed to having sleep apnea. Their facial structure is such that they're more likely to have it. And it's the same thing can be seen with Asian Americans. They're more likely to have sleep apnea than Caucasians.
Just basic bone structure or face structure?
Yeah, facial structure.
Interesting. But that doesn't mean the treatment's any different, right? I mean,
no.
Same kind of diagnosis and treatment. What about people who say, well, what if I raised my pillows? What if I slept with an extra pillow? Do those kind of things help at all?
Yeah, so that's interesting. So if you look at a sleep study, there are certain populations of patients out there who on their back, that's all they have, sleep apnea. They can't sleep on their back. On their left side, on the right side, on their stomach, no sleep apnea. And you know, we call that, you know, positional obstructive sleep apnea. And the treatment would seem to be easy, but it's far from that. We do things like positional devices, and we tell them, you know, just stay off your back. Well, if that's how they'd like to sleep, it's almost impossible. So we tell them to do some ridiculous things, and I'll be honest, my personal success stories with my patients are few and far between of having someone sew some tennis balls into the back of a nightshirt. So if they roll on their back, that's uncomfortable, they stay off it. Put foam in a backpack and put it on it at night. Some people are motivated if they know that that will correct their sleep apnea. They will feel better in the morning, and that's keeping them from CPAP. Most of the time, they come back, say, you know, I'm just not putting on a backpack. I'm not wearing a nice shirt with tennis balls in the back, and they're getting the CPAP.
But this is what I appreciate about this. You're individualizing treatment where you can. I mean, to some degree, it's hard to individualize everything, but why not give it a shot?
Oh, exactly. I understand that CPAP therapy is a lifestyle changing treatment. You're putting something on your face every single night to treat something that a lot of times you're not even aware of. You're sleeping,
right?
But it's affecting your life and your health, and it's important to be treated. So if there is somebody out there who has positional sleep apnea, I will say try these things.
And you have seen some success.
Oh yeah, definitely. I have. But these people, you know, I talked about buy-in before. These people had buy-in.
Yeah.
They were motivated to, one, stay away from CPAP. Two, to feel better.
Do you have another 2 or 3 minutes we can talk about parasomnias just for a second?
I do.
Am I going to get in trouble for keeping you too long? Okay. Because when I've got a doctor of sleep here, especially when we're trying to educate the audience, I at least have to ask about parasomnias. And because you deal with sleep apnea, but you also look at a broad range of issues. How would you define a parasomnia? Is that just a broad category for a disorder?
Yeah. A parasomnia is a disorder during sleep that is not within the normal limits of what you should expect from sleep, meaning that sleepwalking is a parasomnia. Nocturnal or sleep terrors is a parasomnia. And there are some other more interesting parasomnias as well, meaning there is something called sleep-related eating disorder, meaning that people get up and they go and they have something to eat and they don't even recognize it. You know, it's something called...
As in they eat something and they go back to sleep.
Yeah.
And they will wake up and have no recollection of having
right.
done that?
They will go down and they'll be like, how the heck did that... And there are some you know, fantastic case reports of people eating, you know, bizarre stuff. You know, non-edible stuff.
Oh, wow.
But it is interesting. Like I said, sleepwalking. And then other things such as a REM behavior disorder. Not to take too much time, but that's one of the more interesting ones, is that when your body sleeps, you go through different stages of sleep. You go through stage one, stage two, stage three, and then you have REM sleep. And REM sleep is where it's typically thought of where you get the most dreams, but you probably dream in all stages. But in REM sleep, what happens is your body is actually paralyzed except for your breathing muscles. So you can't move your arms, you can't move your legs. And there's a reason for that, because when you're dreaming about, you know, you're being chased by a tiger or chasing someone or punching someone, you're actually not doing that. And there's a sleep disorder called REM behavior disorder where actually you don't have that paralysis, and that you actually act your dreams out. And it's pretty fascinating. And when you hear these stories from folks, it's nice to know that, you know, you can help them with those disorders as well.
And I think, and I'm surmising from having read, not only from what I've read, but from the experience in my own family, that the assumption that would only happen to children, that only kids sleepwalk or these things, certainly adults can suffer from these.
Definitely. So the reason that people think it happens more frequently in children is that children are more likely to have what we call slow wave sleep. And a lot of the parasomnias are associated with slow wave sleep. And as you age, your sleep structure changes, your sleep architecture changes, and you get less and less slow wave sleep as you get older. So the frequency of parasomnias does decrease as you age, but they can still happen.
And someone who's got an REM disorder, it's not every night, right?
No.
Could it be?
It could be, but frequently it's not.
And that probably makes it more difficult to ascertain when it's going to happen or why.
Yeah, and in fact, when we do these sleep studies looking for REM disorders or parasomnias, you know, we're just getting one night of sleep and that's it. So if it doesn't happen, it's not like you're saying, well, you don't have it. It's just, you know, we probably just didn't catch it catch it then. It would be nice to, you know, to catch it on that one night of sleep, but frequently, you know, we're not picking up on those during the studies.
My complaint with these local sleep centers is they are so comfortable. It's like the best night of sleep of your life is going to be in one of these places. It should be like a metal slab.
Well, we want people to get sleep. Now, the beds are comfortable. We've had a lot of people asking what the mattress is so that they can go.
They've actually asked.
But there's a lot of people out there, you know, it's not their own bed. You're in something that looks, you know, it's like a hotel room, but a great bed. You know, you have your own bathroom, your own bedroom. But it's, you know, if you come into the sleep lab, you have wires all over your head and your face and your neck. But I tell people when they're in my office, I say, this is not going to be like a normal night's sleep, but we will get enough information to...
Even if the parasomnia doesn't manifest.
Well, that's different. If you're talking about the parasomnias, you know, I don't know if we're going to pick up on it. Again, it's just one night's sleep, but we might get some hints of it. And those are the things we're looking for.
I guess the most important message for the audience, though, is no matter what's happening in terms of sleep irregularity, there is hope. There are possible treatments, sometimes medically, sometimes just sort of behaviorally. Right?
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, there's a reason that we have a sleep disorder center. And we didn't even touch on probably one of the most common sleep disorders, which is insomnia, and that's a whole other... You know,
I think we'll need a special hour for that.
An hour and a half.
And I mean that very honestly, man. I think of my own family as well, and that's so frustrating to so many people. You know, I hear restless leg syndrome. Do you experience that?
We see and treat all sleep disorders aside from, like I said, pediatrics.
Will you come back and educate us on those sometime?
I'd be happy to come back at any time.
Not that you're a busy guy, Doctor. Dr. Jake.
I got all the time in the world.
Yeah. Dr. Jake Lyons is a doctor of pulmonary critical care and sleep at Rochester Regional Health System, talking about sleep apnea and a number of issues that we all should be thinking about. Because getting sleep is... How many hours of sleep did you get last night, Doctor?
I get plenty of sleep.
Do you really?
Ask my wife. Yeah. I probably sleep too much.
Because you probably know better than anybody that that's not something we can afford to pare back on.
The most common cause of daytime sleepiness in America is insufficient sleep.
Great comment to end on. Thanks for taking the time, Doctor.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We conclude our program on this Friday with a conversation with James Cronkwright from Trek Bicycle, and there is a big event coming up on Sunday. Starts at 8 o'clock a.m. in Mendon Ponds Park. It's Towpath Bike's 4th annual breast cancer ride, run, and walk, and this is a month that a lot of people are trying to educate people across the country on breast cancer and breast health issues. You're going to see pink everywhere. You're going to see all kinds of educational awareness efforts. James Cronkwright is on the line with us now. James, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for taking the time to join us. What was the genesis of this particular event, James? Give us a little history on it.
So this event started about 4 years ago when I used to work at Towpath Bike, and Scott Likely and I were having a conversation, and somehow along the way it came up that we had both been affected in our lives by breast cancer with women in our lives, and we decided to start hosting an event to do some fundraising for the local communities. And this year, again, we've partnered with the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. So all the proceeds of the fundraising of the event stay right local in the community and benefit local organizations.
So it's a fundraiser, and you've done pretty well in the past already. Give me a sense for that.
Yeah, so this is our fourth year doing the event. Last year we raised just over $90,000. And again, all of those proceeds stay local in the community. So it's fantastic, you know, having organizations like Van Bortel, Ford & Subaru, and Amos, Midtown, Canandaigua National Bank. All these great organizations are coming out, you know, as corporate sponsors. They're setting up corporate teams and sending out people to ride their bikes in support of this great cause.
This is a month that is geared toward fundraising but also education. What have you learned about breast cancer? I mean, I know you said that you and Scott have the background. You've been affected. Most of us, someone in our family or extended circle has been. How did you take the time to get educated on this issue?
Just through, you know, a lot of my research on the own. There's some incredible resources over at the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. 1 in 8 people is affected by this disease, so it really touches everybody. So having, again, these just great resources locally, it's just fantastic to get educated. And obviously, you know, for women, early detection is great, understanding family history and just being aware of, signs.
Certainly the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester has become a very prominent figure. And these kind of fundraising events, you can do something nationally, but I imagine it means even more to you to have the money supporting this local organization.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I think one of the things that's helped this event grow so much, this is our fourth year doing it. Last year we had 900 riders and runners. So, you know, having people come out to support a local event and a local charity really changes a lot of tides. When they see money going out of the community, people aren't so quick to jump on and respond. So having everything local is just great.
All right, so the details on Sunday, give it to us.
So the walk starts at 8 o'clock. Registration opens at 7 a.m. at Mendon Ponds Park. It's right in the main parking lot there, right by the lake. So 7:30 registration opens. The walk is at 8 o'clock. Bike rides start at 10 o'clock. There's a 10-mile, a 25, and a 50-mile ride. It's $35 to participate in the event. And there's aid stations. We do lunch for all the riders. There's breakfast catered by Palmer's Foods. And it's just a great day, and the weather looks like it's going to be fantastic.
It does. This is going to be a nice, dry, sunshiny, classic fall weekend. And whether you're a biking junkie or not, Mendon Ponds Park is a pretty cool place to be this time of year, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous out there. The leaves are falling. In the 10-mile course, they tell everybody, you know, plan on an hour bike ride. So kids come out and do it. We have people from 5 years old that are doing tag-alongs all the way up to, you know, 16, 70-year-olds participating. So it really is a family-oriented event.
James Cronkwright from Trek Bicycle. I know this is an important weekend. It's an important fundraiser, and it's all about raising money for these educational opportunities. Thank you for taking the time to join us on Education Friday here on Connections.
All right. Thank you for having me.
My thanks to engineer John Andrus today, and thanks to a diverse group of guests on this Education Friday from all of us at Connections. We hope you have a wonderful weekend, and thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.